Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 8th of November. I have a feeling that we're going to be starting to talk about climate change. One of our guests this hour writes, climate change has registered barely a peep in the presidential contest between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. But no matter who wins, this was written in October, his piece, on November 6th, the next occupant of the Oval Office is likely to become the first climate president. We have two guests with us this hour. The president mentioned a warming planet during his victory speech at McCormick Place in Chicago on Tuesday. And Harry Reid has also made comments about climate change, how it is important to him, and he would like to see some legislation. And, of course, we have the aftermath of a drought over much of the country, and then Sandy, which had a lot of people talking about a warming planet. We have two guests with us, Paul Robbins joining us for the whole hour. Paul is a geographer and the director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of Political Ecology. Paul, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
And Elizabeth Colbert is going to join us for the first half hour along with Paul. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and has written a lot of interesting pieces, including one, and I'd like for her to start the show by telling the story that she writes about in the November 12 issue of The New Yorker, Crossing the Line. She is a staff writer and she's author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. We are going to get, pardon the use of phrase here, flooded probably with phone calls this hour, but you are welcome to join our conversation. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Elizabeth, welcome to you, and thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't we start with you, Elizabeth? Tell the story, because I think it is such a dramatic one, of Eve Mosier, what she did in the summer of 2007.
Sure. Well, Eve is an artist, and she got this idea to kind of make a visual mark around the city of what she called the high water line, which was an elevation of 10 feet above sea level, and it would be the elevation that you would expect water to reach in New York in what was characterized as a 100-year flood, so a flood once every 100 years. But what climate scientists were saying was that a 100-year flood was going to, as sea levels rose, become a once-in-40-year flood, a once-in-20-year flood, and by the end of the century be something that was happening as frequently as once every 4 years. And this upset Eve, and so she wanted people to realize this and get people talking about it. This was in 2007 when climate change had, as it so often does, sort of dropped out of the political agenda. And so she bought one of those machines that you make lines on kids' Little League fields, and she filled it with chalk and with some kind of blue pigment that she found. So it made sort of a light blue line, and she began walking this 10-foot elevation line around Brooklyn and then Manhattan, and just trying to engage people in that conversation.
And then we had Sandy.
And the water came up to that line in many places. It went beyond that line. So it was unfortunately a prescient project.
You wrote in your recent piece, Paul, about the incidence and severity of extreme weather, that it has been rising. I would like for you to answer how so, and also the fact that people are taking notice. I think that's true. People are noticing.
Oh, no question. 2012 is probably going to be the warmest year on record for the lowest 48 states. That's from the National Climatic Data Center. Heat wave that you mentioned covered most of the country, and certainly the upper Midwest this summer, which got people very, very attentive to just simply the price of corn. These are simple economic issues, and nearly two-thirds of the U.S. suffered some kind of drought this year, with about half the counties declaring drought disasters. So that's, of course, those are weather patterns, not climate. But any trend in climate towards more energy in the budget, the total energy budget, global warming, is likely to result in these kinds of extreme weather events.
We are looking at how we're going to deal with this. You write in your piece, Elizabeth, that engineers and marine scientists have been thinking about some sort of storm surge protection system for several years now. Can you describe that in more detail?
Well, New York City turns out to be, as you know, many of our coastal cities are, you know, there's a good reason that people build on coasts, but coasts are now very vulnerable as sea levels rise, and New York City is a pretty low-lying place. Not much of the city gets, you know, very high, and anyone who's been to New York, you know, knows that. And Sandy really proved how vulnerable big parts of the city, very, very valuable pieces of real estate are. So people have started to ask and had started to ask because there have been these projections out there, the very projections, you know, that Eve Mosier was working with, that the city is going to experience more and more frequent flooding. And one possibility is to, and many cities around the world have done this or looking into doing it. Venice, for example, is building a huge barrier system. There's the Thames Barrier. People have been to London, and they may have seen that, which is supposed to protect these cities in times of high water. And in New York, New York has a pretty complicated geography, and so you'd need at least three barriers, it was decided, to protect just Manhattan, really, and, you know, other parts of the city. But the outer part of the city, you know, the sort of the Rockaways and places like that would not be protected by these three barriers, one of which would be on the East River, one of which would be in what's called the Verrazano Narrows, and one of which would be on the Arthur Kill.
And what about in terms of looking at the drought or looking at flooding that's happened in recent years, Paul, here in the Midwest? Are there people who are at work coming up with plans of how to, at least for the immediate future, counter the effects of that? And what do we do about that? What are people thinking? What are we making plans for here?
Well, to be fair, the industry, it's the agriculture itself, is responding without any support necessarily from the state or the federal government. Mm. The crop season has actually changed on a whole range of actual products. So the canneries have moved their season forward. So the agricultural community is responding around these changes already. At the state level, one of the things that is going on is an attention to how to take these global climate models and drive them down at the local level so that people can make some informed economic decisions about what to do. We've got a Wisconsin initiative on climate change impacts, for example, headed by the University of Wisconsin here in Madison, which works with local stakeholders to try to inform the decision-making. Beyond that, it's mostly cities. There's a Chicago climate adaptation plan. Milwaukee's got a heat emergency plan, working on also on stormwater management during extreme precipitation events. So you've got cities hard at work on this, but a lot of it is ad hoc. It's not very well coordinated. It doesn't seem between cities and between states that mm-hmm. there's been a lot of coordination. So the federal presence has been so far quite light.
Hmm. Do you sense that changing? Was it significant that President Obama mentioned the warming planet in his victory speech? Was it significant that Harry Reid yesterday talked about how very important this issue is to him?
Huge. I think it's hugely important, and it's sort of like coming out of the closet on the issue. In 2009, Ken Salazar put an executive order out for an interagency council for climate science centers across the U.S. and landscape conservation cooperatives. These are just efforts to coordinate basic services from and on federal lands and the Forest Service to make informed decisions. So it's going on quietly in the background at the federal level, but to come out essentially and finally say, we really need a plan.
Yeah,
that's a big step, I think, for the federal government.
And of course, we had Governor Cuomo after Sandy at a press conference making these comments, which we'd like, Elizabeth, for you to comment on. Here's Governor Cuomo.
Part of learning from this is the recognition that climate change is a reality. Extreme weather is a reality. It is a reality that we are vulnerable. And if we're going to do our job as elected officials, we're going to need to think about how to redesign, or as we go forward, make the modifications necessary so we don't incur this type of damage.
Redesign and modification, that's a huge, huge project, isn't it, Elizabeth?
Yeah, and I agree that I think there have been, you know, there has been some significant developments in the last couple of weeks. I do have to say, though, that we did just have a presidential campaign in which this was a complete non-issue.
Right.
So the jury remains out on this, I guess. I'll believe it when I see some serious action. But another point that really, I think, needs to be made is in climate circles, I guess, if you want to call them, there's this sort of saying that we need to manage the unavoidable and avoid the unmanageable. And I think it's very important to keep in mind that as the climate changes, it doesn't reach a new state for many decades, unless even at the point in which you stabilize carbon dioxide, greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere, there's a big time lag in the system. So we are looking at a future, and I should add, and this is the key point, that greenhouse gases are not stabilizing. They are continuing to go up and up and up. So right now we have basically guaranteed that for the rest of our lifetimes and for the rest of the lifetimes of many, many of your listeners, the climate is going to be perpetually changing. So we don't even really know exactly what we're heading into, though we do have projections on that. But unless we take steps to really, really seriously reduce our carbon emissions, this process is just going to keep going, and it's going to potentially reach a point of being unmanageable. You can't engineer your way out of it. You can't engineer your way out of such a ferocious drought. You can't, your agriculture can't adapt. So the question, there are two, sort of parallel tracks that have to go on at this point, and they are both humongous efforts.
Mm-hmm.
One humongous effort. There are two humongous efforts, and one is to redesign your energy system, and the second is to redesign your infrastructure to cope with what is coming, what we know is coming.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that analysis, Paul?
Oh, absolutely, very strongly. I think we're in a state of lock-in to some degree of warming, and that mitigation, that is the effort to change our carbon footprint, is mission critical. But I would agree also that you're probably going to see more federal action on adaptation all of a sudden than you are on mitigation, which isn't an encouraging outcome by any stretch of the imagination, but it's real. And I think that's where a lot of energy is going to get focused initially. The shale gas boom has really undermined a lot of efforts to get out of a carbon-based economy in a way just by lowering prices. And there's a lot of shale gas down there from fracking, from hydraulic fracturing. There's just a lot of carbon that is still going to come out of the ground under the current economy, which is a very serious issue.
Let's go to phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, perhaps because we can no longer avoid an unmanageable, which may be here, and people have realized that it will be here before we thought. We are looking at the issue of the warming planet, and big name politicians, the president being one in his victory speech, making reference to the warming planet. Governor Cuomo, of course, and Mayor Bloomberg in New York talking about this during Sandy. Maybe the time is here that we have realized that we need to look at our infrastructure so buildings and roads and people don't get flooded out during these events, which are with us now and will be with us more frequently. And then on a longer term, we may want to look at avoiding what may be unmanageable. And how do we do that? How do we do that? How do we accomplish that politically? Do we have the political will to confront this issue post-Sandy and post-election? 800-486-8655. To your phone calls momentarily, our guests are Elizabeth Colbert, who is with us for the first half hour, staff writer for The New Yorker, author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Paul Robbins, geographer and the director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of Political Ecology. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now on a warming planet. Jerry in Sheboygan, hi.
Good morning. I've been listening to the discussion here. Had a couple comments and then a couple questions. I heard recently that a 1 degree rise in climate cuts crop production by 10%. And then I was watching a Frontline recently on these climate deniers and how they have done such a good job persuading people that it isn't a problem, and they're funded by some of these groups and large corporations that have a vested interest. And even in our own state, you know, we've made it more difficult to create wind turbine farms now due to changes in the legislature since Governor Walker took effect. So I guess my two questions are, is the change that might have to come out of Washington because of all these deniers and the people in charge of the House science area, including our own Sensenbrenner, are not in favor of making any changes or doing anything. Is the change going to have to come from state and local levels more than perhaps the national level? And the other thing I also read and watched was, is population growth, energy production, poverty, and all of those things have to be addressed at the same time as just climate change, that we can't do it as a single item, but it has to be encompassed in a larger area or group, I should say.
Large discussion areas. Paul, you want to start?
Well, on the question of the scale at which these kinds of efforts occur, so far it has really been a municipal and state level effort. The mayor's climate protection agreement, for example, while it doesn't have any teeth, has really transformed the way cities talk about planning for growth and planning for the climate at the same time. That's local population growth, not in the sense of like global population growth. So you've seen a lot of activity at this sort of local level, and it's really just a question now of how scalable that stuff is and where the federal government can get the most bang for its buck. But I do think that despite some intractability, things have gotten kind of postpartisan. I think they're going to continue to trend that way as real events outpace political ideology on the ground. Just to have Chris Christie marching around in really tough, storm-ravaged environments, I think was important. I think was politically important.
Mm. And let's let Elizabeth get her final word on this. She's going to leave us shortly. But Elizabeth, your response to that, too, the political will, the postpartisanship. Do you see that in New York? Do you see that nationally?
Well, one of your listeners' question is sort of, the second question was sort of the question of the century, really, I think, and that is, you know, are these problems that we can solve without, you know, sort of solving all of the world's problems, which are problems of global equity and
mm-hmm.
you know, how we live versus how people in much poorer nations live, and the ways in which if we all live like Americans, this problem would only be, you know, that much worse. How's that? And we seem to be, you know, heading in that direction, and we can't really condemn other people for wanting to live the way we have lived for the last several decades. So these are huge questions, and some of the, you know, scariest part of all this, to be honest, is that everything is, you know, imbricated in this huge question of global equity and global population growth, which is also a really a huge issue. And can we solve them independently or not? And are we ever going to solve these problems? These are huge issues, and so it's not very easy. And that is a problem. That is why we are exactly why we're in the situation we're in now. But it's not easy to see a way out of these issues. They're not easy issues to solve.
No, they sure aren't. They are just huge issues. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Colbert with us, the first part of the program. Paul is staying with us the whole hour. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. And I would like for you to comment on that, Paul, because it does bring to mind so many huge questions: how we live, what we eat, what we drive, whether or not we're to be emulated in other parts of the world. Just the whole way we go about conducting our lives, these are huge issues.
Well, the climate is obviously a product of a more broad change in the global economy, the advancement of a whole range of regional economies. And so that would make it appear, and population will probably top out at 9 billion when it stops growing, 9, maybe 10, about the middle of this century. So we're going to face change. I wouldn't want to be apocalyptic, that's all, that these things are tied together, but we can imagine whole alternative ways of organizing the economy, particularly in economies that aren't already locked in the way we are, to certain dependence on a particular kind of energy technology. There might be a way to work with countries like India and China to imagine a totally different kind of energy economy, even as they build it, so that they don't have to reproduce all of the dysfunction that we've experienced. So there's opportunities here, and there's an opportunity, I think, to think about these things as conjoined in a good way.
What do you mean, a reliance on cleaner forms of energy?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you look at what the Chinese government managed to do by pricing all U.S. solar producers out of the market, they poured an enormous amount of solar technology, jump-started an economy that hadn't existed even less than 8 years before. Now, there are prices to pay for that, and it may not be the smartest investment relative to something else like wind energy, but these are sort of small, wonky questions compared to the opportunities that they present.
Yes.
New
right.
economy.
Right. So do you see the political will of that happening in this country as well on a couple levels? Do you see a stimulus bill, perhaps, to make sure that power sources are underground, that buildings can resist major floods, that agriculture can resist major drought, something to happen that would happen now in order to protect us as these bad weather events happen, and then long-term an economy that really is going to shift to what you just described?
I sure hope so. I do think that the less we make this about the climate, politically, the more traction you're going to get. So instead of a climate bill, I can well imagine the farm bill being reimagined with these questions in mind. I can imagine other kinds of emergency management bills being reimagined with the facts included. Mm-hmm. So that we're thinking about these in all of the legislation, because if somebody tries to march out a climate bill now, I agree strongly with what was said here earlier, that's a tough one. That's a tough one to get started for practical reasons. But that doesn't mean that these middle-term or short-term solutions can't be greeted with political warmth. Gaylord Nelson said, whose namesake our institute is, said that the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment and not the other way around.
Hmm.
So I think you know, there are businesses out there who are interested in working with the environmental community.
Right. Thanks, Jerry, for the call. Our number and lines are open for you, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Is there a post-election, post-Sandy potential political will to look at this issue short-term and long-term in this country? And we're welcoming your thoughts. Our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio is Paul Robbins, geographer and the director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of Political Ecology. Nancy in Bayshore, hi.
Hello.
Yes, Nancy, go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I'm just calling to say that, you know, I watched a speech that Mitt Romney made at the end of the campaign. He was talking about how Obama was stopped. He could stop the ocean from rising. Now, and these people were just went wild with that statement, and they really don't believe that there's anything going on here. They think it's all a farce, a fallacy, that the climatologists and all these scientists are making it up for their own benefit. It's just absolutely absurd.
Nancy, stay with us. We happen to have the statement that Governor Romney made during the campaign. Let's listen to this and see if a lot of people would agree, and it keeps the political will from becoming any kind of political will on the warming. Here's Governor Romney.
President Obama promised to begin to slow the rise of the oceans. And to heal the planet. My promise is to help you and your family.
All right, Paul, what do you make of that?
So much to say about that. You know, first I would just say that the punchline, right, was I want to help you and your family. And I can't emphasize enough how adaptation efforts and innovation can be part of economic activity. And that's certainly what this administration has begun to stress. So the false choice, in other words, between jobs and the environment is the one that was being spoken of there most strongly. But the other part, coming really back more to the question, there was the Viking king of England, King Canute, I think, put his throne into the beach sands to hold back the sea, and of course he was inundated, and it said that his point was to show that even a king can't stop the weather or the tides, and I think that's where we're going to be on this. I think he was throwing red meat to his constituency at the very late in the process of mm-hmm. the election. I think deep down, everybody knows that the water's rising.
Nancy, what do you want politicians to do?
Oh my God, I don't know how they can fight these people. It's, we've got a whole House of Representatives to deal with, and I don't know how we're going to deal with that. And especially, we have people on the Science Committee like Sensenbrenner. That's, come on, think about that. It's how can we possibly, if the people on the Science Committee are people that don't believe in climate change, that's just, what are you going to do?
Well, Paul, we though have had these major events take place, the drought, Sandy, and it's affected so many people's lives. You can't spend billions of dollars to rebuild without thinking about the fact that it may happen again sooner rather than later.
I think that's right, and it isn't just people who've been put out of their homes, and this goes to the question. Dow, for example, a major multinational corporation, has started looking at the wetland parts of the coastals, the Gulf Coast, where they have their operations, and they realize that something's going to have to be done along the redevelopment of the coast to protect from storm surge and the other kinds of things that present a real economic risk for them. So they're working with the Nature Conservancy as a really interesting example. So these are the people, of course, who historically have been the supporters of the Sensenbrenners and others. So I think that the leakage of knowledge into the political parties will often come from constituencies and very strange bedfellows.
Mm,
so if Dow Chemical can be convinced that something should be done,
right,
then I think that they can get the, that may not get the ear of the real deep ideologues, but, they don't make all the decisions.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Nancy, very much for the call. An email come in from Charlie. It said that animal agriculture contributes more to global warming than all of the cars, planes, trains, and other transportation modes combined. Is a plant-based diet good for the planet? Is there any action that an individual can make that's more important to minimize climate change?
Well, there's the immediate question of sort of the balances and trade-offs of different kinds of individual decisions, which I think are important to think about and to calculate. I think there's a case to be made in methane production and the like, very, very heavy in animal agriculture and so on. But one of the mistakes we don't want to make is to freight all of this onto individual decision makers, because we're confronted with just a huge range of weird decisions about what to buy and what to turn on and what to turn off. We should be living lighter on the planet. We should make informed individual decisions while at the same time thinking about how to regulate things that we can't control by ourselves. So I do agree strongly that individual decisions are going to be critical. But if you look at what some agricultural production has done in this state to begin to capture methane and actually lower the amount of nutrients that are going onto their fields by actually producing biogas and selling it back to the grid, there's real chances for ways that you don't just throw the farm economy overboard. You bring it in to a more sustainable kind of future. Mm.
Yeah, we need to do a show on that down the road. That'd be interesting. Steve in Eau Claire. A lot of Eau Claire people today. You're all tuned into us.
Hi,
Carl. Hi, Steve.
When I'm listening, and I'm listening to this gentleman speak, and I'm sure there's a lot of sense to what he's saying, but what I'm hearing is, he wants to sort of change the human condition, who we are, what our aspirations are, from sort of an individuality into sort of a groupthink. And I just wonder if there's something, rather than regulating behavior, if there's some innovation or adaptation would be better then, because I fear that once you go into the zone of regulating behavior, the regulators that will rise to the forefront will be the people who are regulating for the good of everybody, but also regulating for their own personal gain. And I just love freedom, and I want to protect freedom. And I, you know, I, that's how I feel. And I want to hear your response.
What
kind
of, Steve, what kind of regulations are you worried about?
Well, I mean, just earlier you said, you know, natural gas is a big problem. It's a big, you know, but if you're a guy with a family heating your home, any natural gas dropping down to the 1970s and 80s prices is a, you know, an economic boon. I think that from his point of view and my point of view, that the sort of impact of, you know, I mean, you know, he's saying you're destroying the planet by heating your home. And I'm thinking, I'm heating my home and taking care of my family. I just think we have sort of different viewpoints about the, you know, I think that he wants to regulate our behavior rather than innovate. And so I think that if you take sort of tone down that we're going to regulate behavior and tone up the we're going to innovate and figure out what's going on and innovate and work together rather than sort of a small, relatively elite group of people deciding what's best for everyone.
All right, Paul.
Yeah, I welcome that. I welcome that intervention. If I came across sounding like I didn't believe that innovation is an important part of this, then I haven't hammered this hard enough. I actually think when you talk about Dow Chemical coming to the table, they're not doing it because they're being regulated. They're doing it out of economic self-interest. So there are all kinds of opportunities for people to make great decisions individually and at the collective level that involve no coercion at all. Why would people begin to think about seawalls in New York except that there's a lot of money at stake in the case of a major repeated storm surge? So it's about people's homes and businesses. So in that sense, absolutely, these are things that people need to decide for themselves. Having said that, some problems are collective problems, which is there's a tendency for individuals to make very rational decisions by themselves and wind up with outcomes that none of them want. So when people get together and make collective decisions without coercion, but rather some kind of collective action, often you get really great results that everybody likes. So I would stress that. And innovation is huge. And on the point of natural gas, it bent the curve in strong defense of natural gas. It bent the curve in carbon emissions, or that is, yes, greenhouse gas emissions, because it's actually a much cleaner option from a climate point of view than coal and underpriced coal. So that's a good outcome for the climate. Having said that, it's bad news if you're a wind promoter because lower prices there mean that there are fewer options, economic options for the development of that industry.
Right.
So it's complicated.
Yeah. Steve, thanks for the call. Ben in Madison, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to make a comment about businesses innovating, but it sounds like you've already covered that, so I want to make a much simpler point. That is, and this is something I've observed in Madison, most of my friends are liberal and at least nominally concerned about climate change and appalled by politicians who would deny it. But the fact of the matter is, people pretty much do whatever they want. They buy cars that use too much fuel. They live way too far from work. They build homes that are three times the size they need for their family. They just do a lot of things that, you know, I can do this. It's not illegal, so I'm going to do it. I'm going to do whatever I want. And that's why I think the approach of mandating things and saying, hey, look, you need to start composting. We're raising fuel taxes. Suck it up and live with it. Some of these things, I think, have to be forced onto us. And I disagree with the last caller talking about, hey, I'm just trying to heat my home. Everybody needs heat for their home. But if your home is 3,500 square feet, you're driving a mile round or an hour round trip each day to work, you need to rethink that lifestyle because it's just not sustainable.
Paul.
Well, I find myself caught between the callers. right? You've got freedom and you've got the need for self-governance and collective self-governance. And climate's just another great example of one of these classic conundrums. But I wouldn't want to fall into too many binaries. I think we're faced with very practical. I think what I was trying to say previously was that we're faced with practical problems. They're real problems that are going to come out of the product of our decision. And in some ways, they give us opportunities that we didn't have 10 years ago. The problems that we're facing bring everybody to the table to help change behaviors and decision-making. So problems here are producing opportunities so that the two callers can find some place to agree.
And thank you very much, Ben, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And was wondering about the confluence of events. There are times, and all of a sudden you can point to, well, this is the time. It's interesting, isn't it, that we had this horrible, devastating storm, Sandy, taking place right before a presidential election. Nobody talking about this issue very much during the election, forced to talk about it as a result of Sandy. And then all of a sudden you feel that, well, okay, it's okay to talk about this now, that these events happen at the same time, and now perhaps people can feel free to at least talk about it. Do you think that's true, Paul?
I wouldn't want to place any bets on the
really?
Longevity of a particular issue in news cycles and in the popular imagination. I tend to lose those bets. But the argument that I would continue to make is that it doesn't matter whether it's noticed, the president and the Congress are going to have to allocate resources to stuff affected by climate change.
Right, right.
That I think, is part of what's happening, is merely that events are getting away from ideologies.
Mm.
So in that sense, you know, you can't, if the news cycle changes, the sea level rise doesn't. And that's interesting to me. I find that what's interesting, something about the imperative of our condition.
Mm, yeah, it's important to remember that, the imperative of our condition.
That does sound really pretentious, doesn't it?
But no, it sounds good.
What I mean.
It's good. I exactly see what you mean. Well, all, this whole discussion calls for those kinds of phrases, doesn't it? It really does.
Well, I think it can be over-grandiose, and I fall that way, but these are also just sort of practical day-to-day
right.
questions about
right.
heating your home, about what the Forest Service is going to do about an enormously expanded wildfire season. That's
right.
That's just a practical, not very sexy, very practical problem.
Let's talk about wildfires for a moment. What about how the Forest Service is responding to that? And are we seeing more of those, and our response to that? Because it's been, I think about the news in the last year, how many days were devoted to horrible forest fire coverage?
We have had a pretty tough set of wildfire seasons in the West. And in part, this is because the season is lengthening and changing into the autumn season, where it wasn't before. And in part, there's these awfully complex ecological effects, like pine bark beetle moving into the forests of the West. Now, is that a product of climate? Probably, maybe. If it is, that, of course, causes die-off, which increases the incidence of fire.
Mm.
You get these really weird, complex interactions, and they're very real. And
mm-hmm.
is the Forest Service responding? As they are, as quickly as they possibly can. But if we were to name this as a climate problem and talk about it a little bit over the long term instead of on a season-to-season basis, we'd probably be doing better.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what we want to do, is think out to the future a little.
Thanks, Ben, for the call. Let's pause for a moment, and we'll return our guest this hour. You may want to look at a piece that he wrote. It was in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, October 25, First Climate President Will Face Challenges. And, of course, this was written before Sandy and before the presidential election. And now there is more of a sense of urgency as people have lost their homes and happened on such a huge scale. And our guest this hour saying that these events are going to happen more frequently. The incidence and severity of extreme weather has been rising, and people are taking notice. A growing majority of Americans, 74%, believe that global warming is affecting weather in the United States, and 20% of poll respondents saying they had suffered harm to their health, property, and or finances from extreme heat wave in the past year. So we're looking at this issue, what we need to do in terms of changing our infrastructure to withstand this kind of climate change, and what we need to do in the long haul, years from now, so we can manage things still and it doesn't get out of our control. Two more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two more of your phone calls. Daryl in Bloomington, hi.
Oh, hello. What we need is leadership akin to the presidential campaign. We need to use that type of resource methodology to educate people, inform people, and motivate and inspire people. It's a matter of prioritizing your investments. If you put it in the stock market first, in the economy crashes, you lose everything. if you put it in renewable energy and energy efficiency and have your homes audited and all these other things, then you save money. It's the best investment that we can make worldwide, and we have to spread it worldwide, and we have to have a campaign equal to the presidential campaign. You have to cover all the media areas, and you and once people are informed and understand what they need to do, it's free, it's painless, and it'll jumpstart the economy, and then you can go all into these other areas and make them work.
Paul.
I love what the caller says. I think that a lot of us have thought about making certain kinds of decisions, but if we were better informed, we could be pound smart instead of penny smart. And I think that's right. I would throw up one yellow flag, so I just strongly agree with that, but I would throw up one yellow, and this last election was very expensive. Imagine if all that money had been put in.
Oh, I know.
Something else. But,
right.
Right, so absolutely right on these points, but one yellow flag is that people have very complicated calculations that they make when they're making decisions about driving cars in their homes. We did a study of chemical users, people who use chemicals, that is, on their lawns across the United States. And people who use those chemicals, inputs like fertilizers and pesticides, are more likely to say that they're bad for the environment than people who don't use those chemicals.
Really?
Well, because they're worried about property values and their neighbors and a lot of very complex calculations. So environmental education, in a sense, or education of our own economics, it's really microeconomics, is very powerful, and we should move forward with really informing decisions. But we have to also acknowledge that people are faced with a huge range of complicated decisions, and this is only one more. So we have to have some sympathy for the fact that the average consumer is confronted with a totally confusing world of certified foods and different kinds of choices for energy that they can't all sort out on their own. We need to be able to act collectively, and that's where the federal government is really a good player. It's not to tell people what to do. It's to help sort through the range of choices and not leave everybody staring at the range of products that they can buy on the shelf and freaking out.
Hmm.
Some calm governance.
Daryl, thanks. Gary in Eagle River, hi.
Hello.
Yes, Gary, go ahead.
Kathleen, I'm probably the world's biggest cynic, and I can explain how the world is going to heck in a handbasket and as well as anybody. But on this environmental issue, 4 or 5 months ago, I ran across a number of lectures on a program that was put together by TED, this Technology, Entertainment, and Design. They have some of the most creative, advanced, bright speakers you can possibly imagine on a whole variety of subjects. And one in particular on this issue is a gentleman by the name of William McDowell. He has been an environmental architect for over 20 years. And listening to that lecture and seeing some of the pictures is absolutely fascinating and stimulating. And it's just something that I can get about as excited as I did as a kid thinking about putting a man on the moon and going to engineering school. It's one of these things where there are buildings now coming online, one of the most efficient and effective buildings in the entire world. It's just come online, and it's been put up by NASA.
Hmm.
Our government has put up buildings like this. There are buildings regularly now being built in the Seattle area that are producing more energy than they're consuming. This William McDowell with his lecture on Cradle to Grave basically is saying we don't need to just stop with our short-sighted thinking about cutting back on energy or having more windmills. You can actually think and figure out ways of being able to produce an environment where we just aren't consuming and throwing away and just recycling things, turning plastic cans into chairs in a park someplace. It's absolutely fascinating, and if we can catch that kind of imagination instead of looking at the gloom and doom, in my viewpoint, that we might have a whole new generation of young kids going to college getting just as excited about saving this environment in the most productive and fun way as we did about getting somebody to go on to the moon.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. We'll track him down. It sounds like a good future show. Do you see similar signs, Paul?
Absolutely. I love what Gary said.
Mm-hmm.
I have the opportunity to see students coming onto campus around these issues here in Madison, but elsewhere. And they're not coming on the same way an earlier generation of environmentalists did. They're coming on campus with a solution focus. They want creative. They want to be creative. They want to engineer, help manage the future, lead in the future. And I think that environmental education is definitely transforming, perhaps maybe too slowly for our purposes, but in a really exciting way. People are coming to think about creatively, how do you work with the public? How do you convene conversations around these things? How do you make the science sensible to people, get people excited, and do whole world-transforming technological changes, which might give us an edge? And I think you see that. I don't want to be too rosy, but I do see a new generation of environmentalism.
Mm. Thank you, Gary, so much for the call. Nice to hear from you. Ryan in Appleton, hi.
Hi. I was calling just because lately I've been reading a lot of articles on the green power in Europe, like Holland's doing anywhere between 90 and 95% of their power through hydropower. And they also started, and I don't know if it's just the Dutch in general, but they actually started not burning, but using garbage for creating energy. Do you have any more info on that, I guess?
Paul?
Well, I would just say yes. A lot of innovations occurring in Europe. I think of Freiburg in Germany. It's a sister city of Madison, actually, and it's just it's a remarkable municipal revolution there in terms of power from solar and other sources, a real vision of sustainability as a collective city enterprise. A lot of exciting things are happening. They happen within, so that's the good news, they happen within an energy economy, which is quite complex, including this question of available natural gas. So I guess what I'd say is, how can we imitate the successes of Europe, knowing that this is not Europe? This is a different kind of culture and economy. Is there an America, North American, you know, Mexico, Canada, the U.S., way of getting to the same kinds of places with the tools that are culturally and economically, you know, within the realm of imagination? And I think the answer is yes, because there's things available at the disposal of European leaders that are not necessarily always the same in the U.S., and I think we have to be practical about those differences. But boy, there's a lot of great examples from Europe of actual technologies, lots of them. Mm. Let's not just keep it to Europe.
Yeah.
There are things going on in India. There are things going on in China. Leadership on this is coming from all over the world.
Thank you very much, Ryan, for the call. Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to call in and give people a heads up to a Frontline show that is archived on the PBS.org webpage.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go, it's the title is Climate of Doubt, and the picture on it is 7th International Conference on Climate Change. It's a very beautiful, it's a very clear expose of the very, very, very well, carefully designed program of misinformation that has been very carefully cultivated and propagated by the oil and gas interests, using paid for scientists to raise doubt about the science regarding climate change, just in the same following the same pattern that the tobacco companies used to raise doubt about the science of the dangers of smoking and secondhand smoke. They're following that model, and it gives one a lot of very good information. And I also would like to say that snail mail letters to our representatives in government carry a lot more weight than emails do.
All right. Thanks so much for the call. Paul.
Well, I would only say that that the caller's right insofar as vested interests who don't want to see certain kinds of changes, either regulatory or cultural, will spend the money available to them, sometimes significant amounts of money, to mm-hmm. control the message. And that's all true. And it's a dark story for all kinds of issues like smoking and lead paint, lead in gasoline. There are all these terrible stories that this is sort of that this recalls. But again, I think people practically have their eyes open and they're seeing reality, which can't be, stories can't make everything vanish. And in that sense, I think, again, events have gotten away even from the deniers, as well as they've gotten away from an environmental community that's not necessarily fully prepared for Plan B. What do we do with the world changing?
And we need to end at that point. Thank you, Paul, so much for being with us. It was a good hour. Paul Robbins, our guest geographer and the director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, author of Political Ecology. We also thank Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer for The New Yorker, for being with us the first half of the show. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. We'll be with you again on Monday at 9 for All Things Political. Thanks for listening.